Exodus chapter 21, beginning in verse 1. Now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. If you buy a Hebrew servant, he shall serve 6 years. And in the seventh, he shall go out free and pay nothing. If he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. If his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. But if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master shall bring him to the judges. He shall also bring him to the door, or to the doorpost, and his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. And if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. If she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people, since he has dealt deceitfully with her. And if he has betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. And if he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. Amen. Now, chapters 21 to 23 are commonly referred to as the Book of the Covenant. Sometimes chapter 24 is included with that. If you look at chapter 24, specifically at verse 7, it says, then he took the book of the covenant and read in the hearing of the people, and they said, all that the Lord has said, we will do and be obedient. Now, that may not just be confined to chapters 21 to 23, but it certainly includes chapters 21 to 23. Remember that last time we saw that the Ten Commandments ended, and then the people react according to chapter 20, verses 18 to 21. They ask Moses to function as a mediator. They don't want to directly face God. And so Moses then returns to the top of the mountain, according to verse 21. So the people stood afar off, but Moses drew near the thick darkness where God was. So Moses goes back up to the mountain to receive these laws, to convey them or to bring them to the people of Israel. Now, the connection between chapters 20 and 21 to 23 is pretty simple. You have the general principles, the Ten Commandments stipulated in chapter 20, and then in chapters 21 to 23, you have the outworking of those general principles in society. We oftentimes refer to this as the judicial law. So I want to look first at the application of the Ten Commandments in verse 1, and then secondly, we'll take up the law concerning servants in verses 2 to 11. But as I said, there is a connection, a tight connection between chapter 20 and then chapters 21 to 23. So say, for instance, the sixth commandment, you shall not murder. It's straightforward. It's pretty obvious. But when it comes to the civil polity, how do we flesh that out? Well, within this particular chapter, chapter 21, it goes on to make a distinction between what is called murder and what is called killing or manslaughter. So what you find in 21 to 23 is concrete application of the Ten Commandments. In fact, Walter Kaiser makes this observation. If you look at verse 1, it says, now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. Kaiser said, while these judgments deal mainly with temporal matters, they nevertheless are based on one or another express commandment in the Decalogue. It is most appropriate, therefore, that these judicial and political regulations given by God to Moses when Moses approached the thick darkness where God was, should be set alongside the Decalogue. The two belong together in time as well as in interpretation. So he says there is a close connection between chapters 20 and then 21 to 23. Another commentator by the name of Stewart says, in saying these are the laws you are to set before them, God did not imply that what preceded the 10 words or commandments and the reminders or implications in chapter 20, verses 22 to 26, were not also laws for Israel. Rather, the new term judgments simply helped demarcate a corpus of law, the book of the covenant, that begins to provide greater specificity to the general sense of holy behavior required by the 10 words or commandments. So you've got these general principles in the Decalogue, and then the fleshing out or the application of them in terms of the body politic. Now, with reference to judicial law, it is one of the divisions in a threefold division of the law. Remember that the Ten Commandments we refer to as moral law. The moral law is a revelation of God's will. It is for man wherever he finds himself in the continuum of time. Whether he's in the Old Covenant or he's in the New Covenant, he is always under God's moral law. Then Israel also had what was called the ceremonial law. And our confession describes the ceremonial law this way. It says, besides this law, moral law, commonly called moral, God was pleased to give to the people of Israel ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, and partly holding forth divers instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws, being appointed only to the time of Reformation, are by Jesus Christ, the true Messiah and only lawgiver, who is furnished with power from the Father for that end, abrogated and taken away. So the ceremonial law was for Israel specifically in the Old Covenant. We're not under that ceremonial law. Christ fulfilled it and thus abrogated it in terms of any abiding validity for the people of God on this side of the cross. And then there is a third division, and that is called the judicial law. And that's what we find specified in chapters 21 to 23. You see a lot of judicial law as well in the book of Deuteronomy. In many respects, Exodus and Deuteronomy are parallel in terms of the application of judicial law. Leviticus tends to lean more towards ceremonial law in terms of what conduct was necessary for Israel in terms of the cult. The religious worship of God. Now, in terms of the judicial law, our confession tells us that the judicial law expired with the state of the people of Israel. So when the Commonwealth of Israel was no longer, in terms of the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, those judicial laws expired with those people. However, the confession goes on to say that the general equity of those laws pertains. And we'll deal with that in just a moment. But the judicial law governed the people of Israel during their tenure in the land. In fact, when you look at Deuteronomy, very often you'll see that appendage with reference to the giving of law, judicial law, so that you'll know how to conduct yourself in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. In other words, the people of Israel go from Egypt, then to the plains of Moab, and then they go into the land of promise, and there they're supposed to function in a manner that is consistent with the giving of God's judicial law to the people of Israel. Now, the judicial law governed a theocratic nation. Remember that Israel was a theocracy. They had a monarch, to be sure, but at the end of 2 Chronicles, I think, or 1 Chronicles, it says that Solomon sat on Yahweh's throne. And so while a monarchy, it was nevertheless the case that it was a theocracy. God directly ruled the children of Israel in a way that we do not find with reference to the New Covenant. Obviously, the Lord Christ is the head of the church. The Lord Christ is the head of all things. That includes the civil state. But what you find in terms of the theocratic nation of Israel is no longer the case with reference to any nation on earth or with reference to the church itself. So though we have a head that is over the civil sphere and a head that is over the ecclesiastical sphere, there is a distinction, there is a separation. So the judicial law governed their tenure in the land, the judicial law governed a theocratic nation, and as our confession says, and as the Reformed tradition says, the judicial law expired with the state of that people. Now, in terms of the wisdom of the judicial law, we'll get to the general equity clause in just a moment, but with reference to the wisdom of the judicial law, when you read through this, it makes good sense. In other words, if we ask the question, what is God's will with reference to civil polity, we go to the book of Exodus and the book of Deuteronomy, and we see a great deal of wisdom. We see a great deal of information on those things that are pleasing in the sight of a thrice holy God. And I'm reminded of John Gill. He made this observation concerning the judicial law. He says, I cannot but be of opinion that a digest of civil laws might be made out of the Bible. The law of the Lord that is perfect, either as lying in express words in it, or to be deduced by the analogy of things and cases, and by just consequence, as would be sufficient for the government of any nation. And then there would be no need of so many law books, nor of so many lawyers, and perhaps there would be fewer lawsuits. However, we Christians, notice what he says, there's wisdom, but it's not the case that in the New Covenant church, this is necessarily the way it's going to be for those in the church. Listen to what he says. However, we Christians, under whatsoever government we are directed to submit to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake and for conscience' sake, even to everyone that is not contrary to common sense and reason and to religion and conscience. And then he says, see Romans 13, Titus 3, and 1 Peter chapter 2. So on the one hand, the judicial law of Moses would provide a great digest of laws for any body politic to govern with. It would reduce the number of law books. It would reduce the number of lawyers, which would always be a fantastic win. And it would reduce the number of frivolous lawsuits. So there is wisdom in terms of the judicial law. But John Gill does not move from that wisdom of the judicial law to suggesting that the civil government on the other side of the cross is duty-bound by God to enforce the civil laws of Moses. Now, that brings us to Martin Luther. Martin Luther, who many claim to have been an antinomian, I don't think he was an antinomian. He just stressed that second use of the law, the pedagogical use. For Luther, justification was everything. And so for Luther, the use of the law in terms of pointing men to Christ was where he emphasized. But if you look at his catechism, he does not disregard the normative use of the law. He himself said concerning the judicial laws of Moses, he says, nor would it be a sin if the emperor used some of the civil laws of Moses. In fact, it would be a good idea if he did. Therefore, the sophists are in error when they imagine that after Christ, the civil laws of Moses are fatal to us. And that's from his commentary on Galatians. Now, again, these men appreciate the wisdom of the judicial laws of Moses, but they don't move forward to the point where they are saying that the government, the civil government on this side of the cross, is duty-bound to enforce the judicial laws of Moses. Enter what has been called Christian Reconstruction. This started in the 50s and the 60s. It really got going in the 70s, kind of fizzled out a bit in the 80s or toward the end of the 80s. And Christian Reconstruction is also known as theonomy. The word theonomy literally means God's law. It's a great word, theonomy, theos and nomos. You combine those two words into theonomy and you get God's law. Now, the main proponents of this were fellows by the name of Roussos John Rushdoony, a man by the name of Gary North, and then another man by the name of Greg Bahnsen. All three of these men are dead now. Subsequent to Bahnsen's death, or actually North just died in February, but he, again, kind of fizzled out in terms of the theonomy stuff. But these men were very prolific. And again, in the 70s and 80s, they wrote a ton of books. These three, and then a couple other fellows, guys by the name of Gary DeMar and James Jordan. Well, they said that the civil laws of Moses are not only wise, but modern governments are duty-bound under God to enforce the judicial laws of Moses. That's the distinctive position of theonomy or Christian Reconstruction. Now, the movement called theonomy demands the enforcement of the judicial laws by the modern civil state. So that means Justin Trudeau is duty-bound under God to enforce the civil laws of Moses. That's essentially what the theonomic position means. Now, there's a great deal of confusion about theonomy today. It's made a bit of a resurgence in all places, of all places in Canada. And I think at times, though, people simply think that theonomy means the application of God's law. If that's what they mean, hey, I got no problems with that. But if they mean theonomy in its actual definition, in terms of the civil government being mandated by God to enforce the civil laws of Moses, then I think we've got a bit of a problem. Greg Bahnsen, in his Theonomy and Christian Ethics, made this, he's got several points in the preface to the second edition, several points that most Reformed people would agree on, except probably for 2 points. Number 8, he says, civil magistrates in all ages and places are obligated to conduct their offices as ministers of God, avenging divine wrath against criminals and giving account on the final day of their service before the King of Kings, their Creator and Judge. Now, on the surface, we'd probably say, yeah, they are duty-bound. Again, you run into some problems with the New Testament when you assume this particular position. There is not a theocratic nation anymore. There's not a separate Commonwealth of Israel occupying a particular land, having as its direct theocratic king the God of heaven and earth. So to move from this would be a good idea to they must enforce this is a difficult step to support with the New Testament documents. He says in point number 10, the civil precepts of the Old Testament, standing judicial laws, are a model of perfect social justice for all cultures, even in the punishment of criminals. And this is the rub. This is the bottom line. They believe that the civil government must enforce not just the civil laws of Moses, but in particular the penal sanctions with reference to those judicial laws. So in other words, the civil government today is duty-bound by God to punish with the sword all of the particular crimes that are specified in the Old Testament. Now, I suspect that we can have a robust appreciation for God's law, have a robust appreciation for a role of the civil magistrate where he does engage in that particular aspect of law-keeping and enforcement, but with reference to theonomy, again, the New Covenant, the New Testament, does not support this direct correlation, that the government is duty-bound under God to fulfill the application of the judicial laws of Moses. Gary North on several occasions says that the government is in a covenant with God. Now, when you ask the question, which covenant? There's never an answer. The only operative covenant that I'm aware of today is the New Covenant. And the New Covenant does not specify any terms or features for Justin Trudeau to carry out the application of the judicial laws of Moses. So again, I think the position of John Gill and I think the position of Martin Luther has more biblical warrant. On the one hand, it is just. On the one hand, it is wise. On the one hand, it would be good. But to make that step into saying, now it is the case that the civil government today is tasked with enforcing the civil laws of Moses is a step that I do not think the New Testament corroborates. Now, just a bit of my background. I've dealt with this a bit. I've read a bit of these men and their various books. They make a lot of great points, but they're not historically or consistent, rather, with historical theology. I think the Reformed position does a better job at providing a workable framework for how we do law in civil society. I think that general equity clause is most helpful. It goes on to say, with reference to the judicial law of Moses, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution, because the Commonwealth of Israel is dissolved. No more theocratic nation, no more special people of God living in their own particular land, no more judges appointed from, you know, a central sanctuary. None of that stuff obtains. So the confession says, not obliging any now by virtue of that institution, but then it goes on to say, their general equity only being of moral use. Now herein lies the rub. How do we find what the general equity is? How do we sort of go through these laws, parse through the various sort of details that we're going to find in the coming weeks in Exodus 21 to 23? How do we know what we can apply? How do we know what we should apply? And how do we know what is absolutely positive in terms of application? I think Francis Turretin offers a bit of a framework to help. I don't think this is foolproof. I think we still have a lot of work to do. And I would suggest that when we move through these particular codes or these particular laws, some of the things that I bring are going to be tentative. Like the whole thing tonight on dealing with servants / slaves. Brethren, I've got a limited amount of time on a Wednesday to prepare these things. And there's some densely packed information here that I'm not, you know, in a firsthand sort of a way in tune with. I've not ever been in Old Covenant Israel, haven't had a servant, haven't been a servant, certainly am, you know, foreign to some of these things. So some of the interpretations, some of the applications are going to be tentative. And I say that at the outset. I mean, when we get into the eye for eye, tooth for tooth, all those sorts of principles, there's some tough things to sort of, you know, slug through on here. But I think Turretin offers a good framework in terms of how do we appropriate a general equity use of the judicial laws of Moses. He says, first, that which prevails not only among the Jews, but also among the Gentiles is of common right. So basically, he would exclude anything that was only appropriate to the Jews. If it's appropriate to the Jews only as Jews, then it doesn't have that sort of general equity that we can extrapolate and apply to Gentiles. But things that are applicable to Jew and Gentile, when it comes to, you know, murder, when it comes to adultery, when it comes to those things that are crystal clear in terms of their attachment to the Ten Commandments, well, then that's a good sign that we can grab some general equity there. I mean, this first section, what do verses 1 to 11, even, you know, if we trace all these case laws back to a particular general principle in the Decalogue, most likely it's the eighth commandment that we're dealing with in verses 1 to 11. I mean, there's no bodily injury, there's no death, there's no destruction. It typically is an issue of property. And while we're not going to suggest that the slavery in Old Covenant Israel was chattel slavery, nevertheless, there are business transactions and liabilities and assets involved in the passage that we have to deal with. So it's most likely an eighth commandment sort of a thing. Then he goes on to say, second, what is found to be conformed to the precepts of the Decalogue and serves to explain and conform it. So if you can say, for instance, when you get later on in the law, you've got sort of admonition on a flat roof to have a fence around the top of the roof. Well, why? So someone doesn't fall off and break their neck and die. You can see how that's connected to the sixth commandment. What's a general equity principle? You should put a fence around your swimming pool or, you know, make sure you ensure the safety of persons that are on your premises. Now, obviously, people can take that too far. You know, somebody can slip on a banana peel out front and sue us into oblivion. That's not necessarily a good thing. But we should, as far as we're able, try to provide a safe place. That's why I don't mean safe place from trigger warnings and that sort of thing. But, you know, typically I try to keep the sidewalks free from snow and ice during the inclement weather so that persons don't hurt themselves. Where'd you get that big bruise on your head? Oh, it was at that lousy Baptist church on Wellington because they don't shovel their walkways. Well, no, that's not responsible. So when it's directly connected to the Decalogue, again, he says that general equity is more obvious. And then he says, thirdly, the thing so repeated in the New Testament that their observance is commended to Christians. So again, a framework, not an exhaustive one. It's easier to be a theonomist. Well, the magistrate has to, you know, apply every single thing that he finds in Exodus 21 to 23. That would be an easier way to go. But again, when you look at the New Testament, the emphases there, you don't find that. You find the apostle tell us to let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. When you get to that New Covenant era, that New Covenant system, the Apostle Paul is writing at a time when there's an emperor in Rome. And Paul does not say, we need to overthrow the emperor, we need to institute a monarchy, and we need to get back to an Old Covenant sort of Israel or theocratic sort of a structure. That's not the emphasis in the New Covenant. That is not the emphasis. The people of God are told to function under whatever government system they find themselves under in a manner that is consistent with God's holy word. Be faithful. Don't compromise, obviously. Don't sin. Don't transgress. Don't, you know, violate the law of God. But be respectable, upright citizens, paying your taxes and doing those things that God has called you to do in the civil polity. So with reference to the judicial laws of Moses, again, the primary ways of going after it is either A, there's a strict correlation between what we find here and what, say, for instance, the liberal government must impose in our own situation here in Canada, or the larger swath of the Reformed tradition is more akin to what Turretin says. Figure out those things, those principles, a bit of hermeneutics with reference to extrapolating the general equity out of these laws and seeking to make application of them in the situation that we find ourselves. Now, turning to the law concerning servants, there's three things in verses 2 to 11 that deserves our attention. First, the limitation on service. Secondly, the acquisition of a family during service. And thirdly, the protection of female servants. So those are the three things dealt with under the law concerning servants in verses 2 to 11. Now, in terms of limitation on service, you've got this concept of slavery or servanthood, not only in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament. I'm pretty sure when I preached through Colossians, I dealt with slavery in the New Testament. In the Roman Empire, there was a lot of slaves, and slaves were not what we typically think of. Our minds, at least for me as an American, it's typically married to the concept of chattel slavery when men were kidnapped from their country and brought as property into another country. That's not the slavery that you find in the New Testament. That's not the slavery that you find in the Old Testament. There are prohibitions against that type of slavery in the Old Testament. New Testament, it was, you know, once said that if they uniformed or put uniforms on the slaves, that would be a bad idea, because then they would know how many there were, and they might just rise up against the Roman government. They would serve in civil service. They would be all kinds of different jobs. It was not, again, what we think of typically, at least from a North American background, in terms of what slavery looks like. Now, with reference to the Old Testament, what we're dealing with here in chapter 21 has to deal with Hebrews. Has to deal with persons that are within the same country. There's laws regulating slaves from foreign countries, but that's not what's in view here. So Exodus 21, 1 to 11, Leviticus 25, 39 to 55, and Deuteronomy 15, 12 to 18 deals with slavery or servanthood in the Old Testament. Now notice in verse 2, if you buy a Hebrew servant. Stewart says the most common vocabulary word used for the servant is ebed, which can mean, and notice, he says, worker, employee, servant, or slave. Anyone in any of these categories came under the protection of Yahweh's covenant law. So just because we see that slave is used or servant is used, again, we need to disassociate from our minds the concept of chattel slavery when men were kidnapped and brought to another country and made to be property. Robert Alter, a Jewish commentator on the Old Testament, says, what is clearly involved is not chattel slavery, but what amounts to a kind of indentured servitude. The Bible does not question this institution, but sets certain limits on it, and as one can see in the subsequent laws, the slave retains basic human rights. Most important that we get that concept. Now, if you look specifically at verse 10, if he takes another wife. So the Bible sees here polygamy, or at least a plurality of wives. Now, I must say, there are certain things that happen in a post-fall world. Things like slavery, things like divorce, things like polygamy, things like things that happen after the fall that wouldn't have been in a pre-fall world, that God provides legislation on so that the innocent or judicially innocent parties or the weaker parties are protected. The fact that there is this statement in verses 7 to 11 on female servants indicates that particular emphasis. There are laws given to protect the judicially innocent or to protect the more vulnerable in society. So those people that say, oh, the Old Testament is barbaric, it's antiquated, it has nothing to do with us, those people don't know what they're talking about. The Old Testament, God's law, was about providing redress for wrongs committed. It was about providing status and protection for those who were sort of vulnerable within society. Now, in terms of the buying of a servant, notice again in verse 2, if you buy a Hebrew servant. Now, there are probably a few ways as to why one would be in this precarious position, but the two most obvious is what we'll deal with. The first is if the person was a thief. Notice in verse 3 of chapter 22. If the sun has risen on him, there shall be guilt for his bloodshed. This is a man who breaks into somebody's house in order to steal stuff. It says he should make full restitution. If he has nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. He'll be sold for his theft into the family that he tried to steal from. Now you might think, that's a bit awkward. I'm not sure that I'd want that guy living with me. Oh, yes, you would, because that's how you're going to recompense. That's how you're going to get paid back. You're going to get servitude from this particular person. And conversely, it does this particular person good. Instead of breaking into your house, he's now living in a house with hopefully discipline and order and rules and structure. Whatever led to him to that point where he broke into your house, hopefully that will be corrected along the way as he begins to learn new habits, getting up at 6 o'clock, doing his devotions, eating his breakfast, heavy on protein and fat, going to work and working hard, things that his parents obviously never taught him. So there's a twofold benefit with reference to a thief who is found and then he is employed in an indentured servitude manner. The second reason was poverty. If a man was poor, he'd sell himself into slavery or servanthood. If you look at Leviticus 25, specifically at verse 39, and if one of your brethren who dwells by you becomes poor and sells himself to you, you shall not compel him to serve as a slave. As a hired servant and a sojourner, he shall be with you and shall serve you until the year of Jubilee. Now, this would be similar to somebody joining the military today. Oftentimes, young guys will join the military. It's a guaranteed income source. There's food, there's clothing, there's a whole host of things. I mean, working at a warehouse, working in a whole lot of situations would very much parallel the sort of a situation that is envisaged in this particular situation. So if you buy a Hebrew servant, and then notice the limitation in terms of his service. He's not chattel. He's not property. He's not, you know, a dignified tool. He shall serve 6 years, and in the seventh he shall go out free and pay nothing. Turn over to the parallel in Deuteronomy chapter 15. Deuteronomy chapter 15, same sort of an emphasis in verse 12. It says, if your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you and serves you 6 years, then in the seventh year you shall let him go free from you. And when you send him away free from you, you shall not let him go away empty-handed. You shall supply him liberally from your flock, from your threshing floor, and from your winepress. From what the Lord your God has blessed you with, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you this thing today. So going back to Exodus chapter 21, the particular emphasis in the law of verse 2 is a limitation on service, which gives sort of the death blow to the concept that this was a slave that was a piece of property and he was owned outright by his owner forever. Now notice, secondly, the acquisition of a family, should this man have one while he's in this position of indentured servitude. Notice verse 3, if he comes in by himself, he shall go out by himself. He serves the 6 years, he came in as a single man, after he leaves, he goes back as a single man. Notice 3b, if he comes in married, then his wife shall go out with him. So he's married. He and his wife go into this indentured servitude situation. When the 6 years are up, both of them exit from that particular situation. But notice according to verse 4, if his master has given him a wife, and she has borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Now it's just here that all of us go, okay, that's it, we're done. This is terrible, it's barbaric, it's horrific. But wait a minute, this man's footing the bill for everything. Most likely, he gave the wife, or gave this man a wife, so that she would bear more children, and thus he would have more servants. Remember, he's feeding them, he's clothing them, he's putting a roof over their head. He has a vested interest in what happens at the end of the 6 years. This is a business transaction. They're not living here on love and fresh air. The man sold himself into this service with a particular view. I want to work for you for the period of 6 years. I want to serve you. I want to benefit in terms of room and board and all those provisions. So along the way, the master says, well, here's a wife for you. Go ahead and have babies. That master, yes, is going to get more servants. And again, I think that sounds pretty barbaric to us, but I don't think it was in this particular situation. So the master is financially responsible for those under his charge. So at the end of the 6 years, the guy who came to him single must leave single. He can't take the wife and the kids. Now, again, it's at this point we say, well, the poor fellow. Well, the poor fellow has options, brethren. The poor fellow can either A, go get another job somewhere else and visit them on the weekends. A lot of people do that. Military service, that oftentimes is the case. Secondly, he could get a better job, make enough money to pay the former master the price of ransom and redeem the wife and the children. He's certainly free to do that. Nobody is keeping him from doing that. I mean, if he's a moron, he can't get a better job, tough. But that brings us to the third eventuality, which is verse 5. Notice, but if the servant plainly says, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free. There may be the actual situation where he says, this is a good gig. I'm not the brightest bulb in the chandelier. I get good food here. I have a nice bed. I now have a wife. I got a few kids. They're treated well. They're looked after. Everybody's happy. I'm going to stick it out. Why not? This is my career. See, it's not always this negative, horrifying experience that we assume, again, with reference to chattel slavery that was practiced in North America. With reference to this particular situation, the man says, I love my master, my wife, and my children. I will not go out free. Now, notice the sign or the symbol of this contractual obligation. Verse 6, then his master shall bring him to the judges. Literally, it's then his master shall bring him to the gods. Typically, they will translate that as judges. It could be bring him to God. In other words, whatever this transaction entails, it's either before Yahweh or it's before Yahweh's representatives, which are the judges. Either way, it is a solemn occasion. And then we see the symbolism involved, or the sign that's involved. And his master shall bring him to God. He shall also bring him to the door, or to the doorpost. And his master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. Again, that just sounds barbaric to us. You know, he hoists him up to the wall, and he grabs that thing, and he shut. But every single day, girls go to places, and even boys, to get their ears pierced every single day. They pay money to do this. So this should not be a barbaric sort of an assault on our delicate sensitivities. Stewart simply explains, then the boss bore a hole in the servant's ear, probably in the earlobe. Which became a visible sign of permanent commitment to service. This prevented a servant from sneaking away from his boss, relocating elsewhere, and entering into a service contract with someone else. It also provided a permanent reminder to a boss that he had an obligation to employ the servant for life and could not renege on that obligation. So when the servant does what the servant does, according to verse 5, that is an obligation as well on the part of the master. He's agreeing, I'm going to house you, I'm going to clothe you, and I'm going to feed you for as long as you're on this earth. So let's not be too harsh on these masters and too pro-servant here. The master's putting a lot on the line as well in this particular arrangement. And that brings us thirdly to the protection of female servants in verses 7 to 11. Notice in the first place the sale of a daughter. Verse 7, and if a man sells his daughter to be a female slave, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. Again, why would a man do this with his female daughter? Or with his, well, his daughter. His, I guess, by definition, she's a female. I've been thinking about Matt Walsh too much. And if a man sells his daughter, why? Because he's poor. Right? That would be the only eventuality that would induce a man to sell his daughter into servanthood. But the specification is, she shall not go out as the male slaves do. It's not in the same sort of a manner. The male slave serves for 6 years, and then off he goes. No, there's a measure of protection here for this particular woman, such that the male slave doesn't himself enjoy. Notice the purchase of the female servant. So you've got the man. You've got the man selling in verse 7, and then verses 8 to 10 deals with the man buying. And notice, the first condition or the first situation is that the master is not pleased with her, according to verse 8. If she does not please her master, notice this next clause, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. So there's a legal contractual obligation on his part at this point. In other words, when he ponies up the dough for this female servant, he has entered into an obligation. He can't just say, you know what, I don't like you. Your breath smells, you put on a few pounds. I'm just not happy with you anymore. He can't do that, brethren. There's protection here for this woman. Now again, it strikes us as a bit harsh, the language, the concepts, the particular situation, but we don't live there. We don't know what it was like. We don't know that particular environment. We live in a world of Costco's and Walmart's and all those sorts of things. There is a disconnect that we face in terms of interpreting these particular laws. But suffice to say, the woman is protected. If she does not please her master, who has betrothed her to himself, then he shall let her be redeemed. In other words, he's free to break that contractual obligation by allowing her to be redeemed if she has the money or she knows somebody that can pay that redemption price. Notice a further stipulation. He shall have no right to sell her to a foreign people. That's forbidden. That's prohibited. You cannot do that. You must protect this woman, since he has dealt deceitfully with her. Now, verse 9 envisages another possibility. The man bought her for his son. So, verse 9. And if he has betrothed her to his son, he shall deal with her according to the custom of daughters. In other words, protection and finance and all the things that are stipulated in terms of the parental obligation to their children. She comes under that umbrella. She is a protected woman in a society where to be without protection would have been very difficult. In fact, brethren, there's probably more to commend some of these models than the way we find ourselves in our own generation. There is safety built into the theocracy in terms of the most vulnerable among them. And then notice verse 10. So this applies to either the son of verse 9 or the man in verse 8. So if the man in verse 8 decides to go ahead and keep her along, or if the son in verse 9 adds her as a concubine or as an additional wife, notice what verse 10 says. If he takes another wife, he shall not diminish her food, her clothing, and her marriage rights. In other words, this woman who was sold by her poor father into this covenant family is afforded the protection that is common course for all married women in the old covenant situation in Israel. In other words, even if she's not his favorite, he cannot take from her cupboard, he cannot take from her closet, and he cannot take from her marriage bed. Which incidentally, brethren, this is at least fundamentally involved in every husband's duty or responsibility to their wives. You need to make sure they've got food in their cupboards, clothes in their closets, and conjugal relationship in their marriage bed. That's the emphasis in verse 10. Again, you see the protection involved for this woman. She's sold by a poor father. She's sold into a situation that's probably scary, that's probably difficult, and yet the law is structured in such a way to protect her within that environment, to protect her in whatever eventuality may face her. If the guy that bought her doesn't really like her, he's still got moral obligations to her. If he bought her for his son, and that son has an additional wife, or if the man himself takes her and keeps her and has an additional wife, that does not mean she gets shorted or she gets gypped relative to cupboard, closet, or marriage bed. You cannot diminish that. You cannot take that away. Now notice the final statement in verse 11. And if she, or if he rather, does not do these three for her. Now I think the most obvious or the most common interpretation would be the three things in verse 10. If he does not provide for her cupboard, closet, and marriage bed, then she shall go out free without paying money. I don't think it's that. I think it has to do with the larger context. If he doesn't allow her to be redeemed, if he doesn't provide her for his son, and if he doesn't provide for her in light of the fact that she's an additional wife, then that obligation to remain in his employ is broken. She is free now to leave. If he does not do these three for her, then she shall go out free without paying money. So the freedom to depart if he does not carry out these contractual obligations. So at the first glance, we think, wow, that's barbaric. A man is buying a woman, and it just feels wrong. But when you start to investigate a little bit further and you start to understand that this woman is, you know, not in a good way. She's got a poor father in Old Covenant Israel. Not a lot of options for her. Not a lot of Walmart she can work at. Not a lot of colleges that are going to take her. Probably not a lot of men in her pool in terms of, you know, getting married. So this is the next best thing. And yet built into this are all of these protections for this particular woman. And if the man reneges on any of them, she is free to leave without having to pay, without having to, you know, pay some broken contract fee or anything like that. The Lord God is the champion of the vulnerable. He is the champion of the judicially innocent. And as we move through this old covenant law, we will see that on many, 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 many occasions, that God's law is not the barbaric thing it is sold to us as, but it rather is an expression of his wisdom and of his goodness and of his kindness. And again, his ability to redress those things that have come in a post-fall world. The Bible legislates concerning divorce. That doesn't mean go out and get divorced. The Bible legislates concerning polygamy. That doesn't mean go out and multiply wives. The Bible legislates with reference to slavery. That doesn't mean go get slaves. The Bible legislates because in a post-fall world, men engage in these sorts of things. Remember when Jesus is confronted by the Pharisees in Matthew 19. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason whatsoever? What does Jesus do? He points back to the original creation. He says, in the beginning, it was not so. But because of the hardness of your hearts, Moses permitted a bill of divorce to be written. What's the point? If you were in a pre-fall situation, there'd be no divorce laws. There'd be no slavery laws. There'd be no polygamy laws. There would be no laws regulating warfare. There'd be no laws that we find much laws concerning if the world was not fallen. But when the world fell into sin, God in kindness gave law to restrict the wicked, the outwardly vile, from exploiting the vulnerable and the weak. These laws are designed to protect. These laws are designed to keep the body politic in order without abuse and without the sorts of things that are commonplace in, say, a society like ours, where there's oftentimes no sort of redress for people that are victimized, people that are brutalized in marriages and then just discarded. They don't have the sorts of things that this woman in Old Covenant Israel would have had. So in conclusion, we need to remember the function of judicial law. So what we find in chapter 21, verse 1, now these are the judgments which you shall set before them. Not just Exodus 21 to 23, but also the book of Deuteronomy. And again, there are judicial laws in Leviticus, but Leviticus is more heavy on ceremonial. You'll find more judicial in Exodus and in Deuteronomy. Those things were written to take the general principles of the Decalogue and apply them in concrete ways to the body politic. It was to govern the people for their tenure in the land, and it was to restrain the people from ultimately losing the commonwealth. Now, obviously, the law without the Spirit does not effectively subdue the heart of man. And so when you read Leviticus 26 and you read Deuteronomy 28 and you learn the promises of God in terms of curses for covenant breaking, well, that's exactly what happens. It happened in the 8th century with Assyria and the northern kingdom. It happened in the 6th century with Babylon and the southern kingdom. And it happens in the 1st century AD with Rome and Israel as a whole. They broke the covenant. They ultimately gave up the commonwealth. They ultimately gave up or forfeit their status in terms of a theocratic nation under God. So the governing of the people and a restraint of the people from losing what they had. And then finally, when we go through this, we should appreciate the equity of God's law. I don't mean equity the way the modern commies are using equity, but in its real sense. Justness and righteousness. Even if you were a poor woman with a poor father who had to sell you into servanthood in order to make ends meet, there was redress in the law of God and protection in the law of God for one such as you. That is, in fact, equity. Well, I'll pray, and then if there's any questions or comments, we can talk about that. Father in heaven, we thank you for your word. We thank you for the Old Testament law and what it teaches us concerning who you are, and as well, Lord God, what is good in terms of man's life in this present evil age. We ask that you would guide us and fill us with your Holy Spirit and help us to think clearly concerning the application of these things and grant us faithfulness, Lord God, to be walking in a manner that is worthy of your the gospel of our salvation, and help us to just continue to press on in this lower world in a manner consistent with bringing glory to you. And we ask this through Christ our Lord. Amen. All right, any questions? But it's disconnected in that it's not from that family.
Yeah, yes. I guess a person, if they found himself in debt rather than sell himself, he could also sell his daughter to satisfy that.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I would say that on the subject of female welfare, this sort of scenario is probably better for a lot of women, at least in the pre-modern period, than, for example, forced prostitution, as has been the norm in many other cultures. And for that matter, the kind of deprivation that nunnery produces. Mm. Because if we're saying that a master or a son is supposed to provide food, clothing, and relations, well, that's in contrast to vows of poverty mm-hmm. and that sort of thing
that's right.
You see in Romans.
The only one other point I should point out in verse 4, presumably it would be a 6-year stint. So the guy, I mentioned he had options. He could go out and get another job, visit his family on the weekends, or he can make enough money to buy them out of that situation. But it would presumably only be 6 years, right? I mean, I don't know that. I think that would be a good way to understand that. I doubt that the family that was born in that particular condition would then be destined to lifelong servitude. It was probably capped by the 6-year as well. That would be my guess. So it would be tough, but, you know, people have done it. But again, I think ideally, verse 5, what other gig does he have? His wife is there, his kids are there, they're eating, they're clothed, they're sleeping. It's a good system. And he obviously appreciates what he's got. All right, well, fun stuff.